right, thank you, Gautam, and thank you for the invitation to talk about some of my alfalfa work here in a biofuel session. Many people look at me like I'm insane when I say that I'm working on alfalfa as a biofuel, but I think there's some real good reasons to consider alfalfa, and I'll talk about some of them in a second. So why alfalfa? This will be the first thing I talk about, and then move into some QTL mapping work that we've done, a little bit about linkage disequilibrium and its implications for association mapping in alfalfa, and some current work that we're involved with, some next-gen sequencing and SNP discovery as a way toward both facilitating marker-assisted selection and also genome-wide selection. Much of the work I'm going to talk about, not all of it, much of it has been funded through the USDA-DOE joint biofeedstock genomics program. My collaborators on those projects are Jeff Doyle at Cornell, Maria Monteros at Noble, and Greg May at NCGR. So I don't, just cut off. They don't like to hear about alfalfa, I guess. That's a common thing. Okay, it's back, we're back. Okay. So alfalfa is a biofuel feedstock. Well, there are a number of reasons why alfalfa is a very favorable crop to think about in terms of a bioeconomy. One is that it fits very well into farming systems, particularly farming systems with corn, where corn obviously can be used as a biofuel as well as for grain. But alfalfa can provide all the nitrogen a corn crop needs in rotation, in addition to other positive rotation effects. And so if you remove the nitrogen requirement in corn, then of course corn becomes a much more viable feedstock as well. The key to making alfalfa work is separation of leaves and stems. That's a feasible physical operation. The stems then can be gone into fermentation or into co-firing for biopower, depending on which direction the particular market wants. And then the leaves are a high protein animal feed and a very valuable co-product, kind of like DGGs in corn. The breeding goals that we have then for alfalfa, this is actually for forage or for biofuel, is yield. Obviously, yield is critically important. Persistence, this is a perennial crop, so we want to have something that's going to be there for several years. Altered composition, and of course, the big problem with altered composition is that depending on whether we're going to ferment it or co-fire it, we might have different compositions that we want. So from a breeding perspective, if we don't have a clear goal of the market, it's somewhat difficult to alter the composition one way or the other. And in my view anyway, focusing on yield is probably more important. And then, of course, all the other stuff that we always need to breed for, diseases and various pests and whatnot. The first thing I want to talk about is some work that we've done several years ago, mapping QTLs in tetraploid alfalfa. So one of the positive things, I guess, of working with alfalfa is that it's an auto-tetraploid, which makes everything a little bit more complicated, but nevertheless tractable, and with current technologies, it's becoming even more so. Alfalfa exists both at the diploid and tetraploid level, and at both ploidy levels, there is a yellow-flowered falcata subspecies, and in tetraploids, the purple-flowered sativa species, this is referred to as subspecies cerulea at the diploid level. And then their hybrid, which occurs naturally and produces either hemicycla at the diploid level or metacagovaria at the tetraploid level, all naturally occurring and also man-made as well. So we made a cross a number of years ago between falcata and sativa genotypes and developed about a mapping population of about 200 individuals that we phenotyped for a number of different traits in field trials. Joe Robbins, an excellent student I had several years ago, now at USDA, published this paper, two papers in 2007 about yield. This is back before we had good interval mapping tools in autotetraploids. So based on single factor ANOVAs, there's a number of loci that are associated with either regrowth, yield, or plant height in this population. And there's some evidence that some of these yield QTLs are actually also related to yield heterosis, which is something we've long been interested in. And I say these markers may be useful for breeding. We don't have empirical data showing that's the case, but we hope eventually to move this into a breeding program. In addition to yield, Joe also mapped persistence, and we found a very strong QTL across five environments for persistence on this linkage group six. One of the things you can see about the map that we're using here, these are four homologous chromosomes from one of the parents. And so effectively what we have is just partial maps of each of the homologous chromosomes. So we're missing large areas of chromosomes given the marker density that we have at the current time. And one thing we're attempting to do now is just to add further saturation now that we have better technologies to do that. Nevertheless, we identified a major QTL repeatedly, and it might be related to winter hardiness. There's a candidate gene in the vicinity of this QTL, so of course we need to do further work on that. Okay, also we've done some mapping of nutritive value. So this is the detergent fiber analysis. And so acid detergent lignin at both Ames and Nashua shows a peak in this area that accounts for about 12% of the phenotypic variation in the population, which in a population like this with the marker coverage we have, that's not really too bad, I don't think. So we've also identified QTLs for other stem composition traits as well. So the upshot is that, you know, we can identify QTLs, which isn't maybe too surprising. One of the things I realized early on, I resisted doing this initially, but I've come to realize that it would be a lot easier to do a lot of mapping in diploids if possible, assuming there's a good correlation between diploids and tetraploids and genetic control and so on of traits we're interested in. And so we've developed a number of diploid populations as well to start to dissect some of these traits at the diploid level and maybe dissect them in a way that's more specific and more precise than we can do with tetraploids. And it's easier to get marker coverage and so on. Okay, so here are the populations I'm going to talk about in the next couple slides. We crossed Falcata and Cerulea to produce an F1. We selfed one of the F1s to produce an F2 population. So these are C by F, F1, and C by F, F2. And then we crossed two Ceruleas. So Ceruleas are the direct diploid ancestor of cultivated tetraploid, most cultivated tetraploid alfalfa. And this is a C by C, F1. We've developed maps in these. We've evaluated the segregation of loci, and that's what I'm going to talk about in the next slide. And we're just beginning field of phenotyping of these populations for yield, composition, and other traits. So I don't have data on that today. But what I do have is information about segregation distortion. This is a pervasive phenomenon in alfalfa in just about every population we've ever looked at. Let me just orient you here. This is the Metacago truncatula physical map based on whole genome sequencing. And the dotted lines then indicate that there's quite good syntony between the Metacago truncatula physical map and alfalfa linkage maps. This is the C by C F1, the CF F1, and the CF F2. These markers are in these dark areas, which look red on the screen, but I guess maybe look black to you, are indicate markers that have segregation distortion on this linkage group one, which is, you know, quite a bit in every population. If you look at overall levels of distortion in the F1 populations, about a quarter to a third of the markers exhibit segregation distortion, and it's almost two-thirds in the F2 population. So whole genome-wide, lots of segregation distortion. These two numbers, the F1s, are underestimates because sometimes we don't have fully informative markers. One parent is homozygous, so we can't really tell if there's a distortion or not. And you can't really see it here, I guess, but markers that are in green, like some of these are all in green on the screen, and these are markers that are in regions of distortion, but we can't tell because of non-fully informativeness. Okay, so what's the value, what's the point of segregation distortion? Why am I talking about it? Well, the distortion is interesting because most of it is toward excess heterozygosity. And this has been reported in other species as well, in pine, for instance. But I don't know that I've seen any examples of as extreme skew as we've seen here. So, for instance, this is an F2. This is the F2 map of linkage group 7. We'd expect, of course, 25, 50, 25% in each of these classes. And so we're getting things that are extremely skewed. So, for instance, this marker here is not present at all in the in one homozygote class. The other is just 2%, and 98% of the individuals in the population are heterozygous. And then this linked marker similarly skewed, as expected. So this suggests then that there's a lot of genetic load in alfalfa, and that the genetic load, negative alleles, well, okay, there's two possibilities, right? It's either an overdominant phenomenon, which is possible, but it's probably linked recessives in repulsion phase. And what's remarkable about this, and I'd really be happy to know anyone's opinions about what's going on, but we see this in multiple populations of all types, where the same general areas show the same extreme skew, which suggests that there are lots of deleterious alleles. If it's a dominance phenomenon, there's a lot of deleterious alleles linked to just about everything. And so we always end up with heterozygotes, unless it's overdominance, which seems unlikely, but it's possible. Okay, so the bottom line is there's a large genetic load. And interestingly, such as this region right here, these tend to be near yield QTL regions. So not all yield QTL regions are in regions of segregation distortion and vice versa, but there is some overlap, which is interesting. So it suggests that these loci or loci in these regions are associated with fitness and with biomass yield. So we have these populations in the field and to get some phenotypic data, and then we can try to correlate with what we've seen segregation-wise. Okay. So moving from biparental populations, I want to talk a little bit about association mapping. So the problem, of course, in alfalfa and other outbred crops where we're commercializing, at least at this current time, synthetic cultivars, so populations. Looking at a biparental cross doesn't really capture the allelic variation that we have in a breeding population. And so association mapping, or if we had enough markers, whole genome selection would probably be a better way to apply markers and a better way to make great increases in genetic progress. So we looked at an elite tetraploid breeding population. And again, so this would be better than the biparental populations in some ways in terms of identifying QTLs that are associated with yield in something that's actually in a breeder's hands. We genotyped with SSR markers and measured yield in, let's see, in three locations over 2 years, locations being Iowa, Quebec, Canada, and New York, Cornell with Don Vines, and then did some marker associations. Our goal here was to see, well, we didn't really know what kind of linkage disequilibrium to expect in a breeding population, and if we could get by with a relatively small number of markers, that would be great. We used about 75 markers, and based on SSR linkage-based linkage disequilibrium, it looks like that's probably about an order of magnitude below the number we needed to use, but to fully saturate the genome. But nevertheless, we were able to identify some QTLs. So these are a series of alleles on the certain chromosomes based on Metacargo truncatula, the location physically in Metacargo truncatula. And then over here, for each of these five environments, we have, this is a p-value, coded for p-values for the association. So black is a very strong relationship, and then the lighter grays less. But you can see some interesting things. So for instance, here, this marker that's found in Iowa, maybe weakly in Quebec, this marker found strongly in New York and Quebec, which are fairly close and less so in Iowa. And this marker down here, of particular interest to me, which we found very strongly in New York and in Iowa, two pretty different environments, as well as weakly in Quebec. And this is also a marker that was found in that previous experiment I talked about, the biparental cross. So it's sort of a confirmation that we're not just finding spurious QTLs here in this association mapping population, even with a relatively small marker density. Now, one of the interesting things that we found is that if you look at the allele numbers per locus for individual plants, the plants that on average had more alleles per SSR marker tended to have higher yield, higher biomass yield. So more alleles, meaning the plants are more heterozygous. Again, you get into the overdominance, pseudo-overdominance argument, but in any event, there appears to be an association, and this is on the order of 20% of the variation in yield can be explained by heterozygosity. But we didn't see any association at all with the stem composition traits of NDF, ADF, and ADL. So heterozygosity, marker heterozygosity has no effect, as you might expect from the literature. Okay, so this ties back in, of course, to the segregation distortion that I talked about earlier, where heterozygotes are in diploids are fitter, and in some cases much more fit than homozygotes. And I think, although we don't have empirical data for this, but I think we can say that it's probably due to negative recessive alleles in repulsion phase rather than overdominance. So for those of you who don't work with alfalfa has a very bad, very severe inbreeding depression, and this is just sort of supporting evidence of why that is. Lots of deleterious, lots of genetic load, lots of deleterious alleles. Okay, so we can map in both biparental and breeding populations genes or QTLs for important biofuel-related traits. We really need more markers to do a complete job genome-wide, even in breeding population with a relatively narrow genetic base. And I guess thinking about how we're going to integrate this into a breeding program, we need to think not only identifying the individual QTLs and possibly moving individual QTLs or introgressing them into breeding populations, but really with a view toward genome-wide selection so that we can make progress more rapidly. And so, before I get into the sequencing thing, so we're also doing some association mapping in diploid alfalfa for a couple reasons. One is that there's a huge diversity of germplasm that's never been really used at all in breeding, and interploidy crosses are possible, so you can transfer QTLs reasonably easy between ploidy levels. And again, better mapping resolution and easier QTL manipulation at diploids is certainly something that's nice to consider as an autotetraploid breeder. So I had a student a couple years ago, Mohamed Sakirulu, who took about 400 individuals from 122 accessions of the three different subspecies of diploid alfalfa, ran a bunch of SSR markers on them, and then clustered them. And here's a principal coordinates map showing very clear separation over here of falcatas from over here ceruleas, and the natural hybrid hemicyclists fall out right in the middle, as you'd expect. What was kind of interesting is that he found a very clear differentiation of the two falcata types, and although it's not, although it looks like one big swarm, the individuals above this line come from northern parts of Eurasia, whereas those down here come from the southern parts of the cerulea group. And further, interestingly, is that these are separated not by geography, but by habitat. These tend to be along rivers, lowland areas, and these tend to be steppe or drier areas throughout Eurasia, which is quite a broad expanse. And you still see this separation, a separation you don't see in cerulea, which is kind of interesting. This separation was predicted by a Russian taxonomist years ago. So you know, I tell my students that's why we call it research, because we refine the things that have already been published out there. Okay, interestingly, though, the genetic diversity plot that you saw before, if you take those individuals and then we measured 17 different phenotypic traits, composition and yield and so on. And here's principal coordinates of that. And there's no real relationship of genetic diversity with phenotypic diversity, which suggests that we could go into those different groups and possibly find individuals or accessions that have desirable traits and different alleles for those traits. Of course, these markers are not targeted at any particular trait, so you can't say that definitively, but it certainly is possible. Okay, so we were going to use all these individuals then for association mapping based on candidate genes. Jeff Doyle's lab, Sue Sherman-Broyles, his postdoc in Jeff's lab, has been looking at linkage disequilibrium within 5 lignin candidate genes by amplicon resequencing of about 72 individuals from that. They were selected to represent the diversity of the from the previous plots. So 2 of the genes shown here, C-COMT and F5H, these are the amplicons that she used for C-COMT. And then for F5H, there's a very large intron here, so she had to do the 2 exons separately. And here's what the LD plots look like. So LD decays very rapidly in C-COMT, I mean, right down to 0 by, well, somewhere in here, effectively. So, of course, now this is a very broad germplasm collection. This is as broad as, well, at least a diploid alfalfa, and maybe as broad as alfalfa can get. So if you look across all that germplasm, there's very little LD in C-COMT, but somewhat more in F5H. But still, we're looking out to a KB, probably. In this case, we can't go that far, but we're probably going to run out of LD. But maybe, you know, SNPs within exons in F5H are still in reasonable LD. Okay. At a 5% cutoff level, the number of SNPs for these sequences is quite large. So the base pairs per SNP, so this is SNPs present in 5% of the reads that she looked at. These are 454 reads, I should say. 34 base pairs per SNP in C-COMP, down to 15 in exon 2 of F5H, and then a large number of haplotypes. So we have quite a bit of SNP variation, in other words, for these genes. This is actually pretty preliminary results that Sue sent, but she did run a quick association test with C-COMT and found a SNP that is associated with biomass yield in 2 different years in C-COMT, but she didn't see that with composition traits, interestingly. But that's still ongoing, and so we really don't have complete data on that. So the project that we're working on right now is large-scale SNP detection, sequencing stem transcriptomes. We're trying to sequence about 25 genotypes, including elite clones from the breeding programs of the 4 major alfalfa companies, as well as some selected other plants that are in mapping populations and so on. And we've done 3 genotypes initially as a little pilot test with about 25 million 72 base pair Celexa reads. A third of these aligned to Metacargo Troncatula build 3.5. I'm somewhat interested in that. I'm not exactly sure why. It seems like it should be higher than that. But at any rate, that's the way it is now. 155,000 contigs. The average read depth of the contigs is 109, not base pairs. I don't know why that's there. And we identified lots of SNPs. Interestingly, or importantly, these SNPs are in lignin candidate genes, and we can identify sufficient read depth in lignin candidate genes to find SNPs that could be used for markers. So here, for instance, is one gene, NST1, which is a transcription factor associated with S-lignin in alfalfa, S-lignin biosynthesis. This is the entire gene, and you can see the contig depth, you know, varies along the gene, as you might expect. Just this one little area back here is blown up here, and where you can see a very nice SNP. This is probably just a sequencing error, but otherwise we see invariant context around that. And if you break it out by the three different genotypes, you can see that the SNP here is within this genotype. So again, these are heterozygous genotypes, and we're going to see SNPs within each one of them, the other two being homozygous. Okay, so I put, this looks like roughly equal, so maybe it's a GGTT, but we don't really know the dosage. How much time do I have?
A minute over.
Oh, sorry about that. Okay, very quickly then. Okay. Sorry. The big issue, though, is taking these SNPs and putting them into an assay that we can use in a breeding program. Maria Monteros and Yuanhong Han at Noble have developed, using light scanner, high-resolution melting assay that works very well. Here's an example showing that it works. And importantly, it can distinguish dosage. This is critical for us to be able to identify, for instance, you know, here's a CC in a diploid, or four Cs versus three Cs versus two Cs versus one and none. So high-resolution melting seems to be a technology that's going to work very well for auto tetraploids, because we can get the dosage information. And then Maria and Yuanhong have mapped some of these, starting to map SNPs onto the alfalfa map. In summary, okay. Yeah, we can identify markers. We're getting resources that we can use toward marker-assisted selection, although we're not quite there, and possibly mine out of diploid alfalfa. So thanks to my funders, and thanks to all the folks who are working on the project.